Jordan trying to shake off Starks. Oh, what a move!
LeBron James with no regard for human life. Final seconds. Bryant for the win.
Bang! Iverson against Gill, the crowd on its feet. Allen for the win.
Welcome to the Sneaker History Podcast.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to another episode of the Sneaker History Podcast. And this is one of those ones that's one for me, but in this case, it's one for we, because I've got Mike Guillory, my co-host, here with me. Mike, what's going on?
Not too much, man. I mean, get to talk my favorite sports subject, so I'm pretty excited today.
Awesome. And that will be a segue that I will use to introduce our illustrious guest, Guillory. Sorry, and now I gave you a French accent, so there you go. First set of ancestors.
We left them out.
Yeah. Why go right when you can go left? Got Guillory Nathan here. And to Mike's point, tennis is something that I know near and dear to Mike's heart, and it's something I've slowly kind of fallen in love with, and that's primarily through watching one player, Carlos Alcaraz. And I have this other weird hobby, as some of the listeners may know, which is sometimes I will just go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or my local bookstore and just ask them, hey, what are the new sports books that are coming in the next 18 months? And that's how I found out about Guillory and this amazing book that he's written called The Changeover, A Young Rivalry and a New Era of Men's Tennis, which is going to look at the bulk of this episode's discussion, which is the Sinner-Alcaraz rivalry. But I'm going to stop talking and I'm going to let Guillory kind of introduce himself. Guillory, how's it going?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Of course. And yeah, so man, it would not be a sneaker history episode without our tried and true rocking and copping. So for those of you that may be listening because we've got the Guillory bump, rocking and copping is a segment where we talk about the most recent pair of sneakers or apparel that we bought, as well as the one that we find ourselves wearing the most. So Mike, why don't you start us off? What are you rocking? What are you copping this week?
All right. So rocking, I mean, because it's A's, I think my top three favorite sneaker, and we got Giddy here, so I had to break these out. I had
Ooh,
to.
Yeah, classic. Classic.
Yes. So this pair, they just re-released this color for both genders. It used to be a traditionally women's exclusive back in the 90s. Now it's men and women, so I had to grab the pink pair. But copping, I think right now, we got August 16th. I think Nigel Sylvester's Jordan 1 Low. We'll see what happens. That's my copy.
Are you saying time will be an issue for that? Because I think
I'm
that's
sure
what
a lot
Nigel
of things
will want.
Be issue.
Fair enough. I'll go ahead and go next. Because we are talking about tennis, rocking and copping. So one of the shoes I bought recently was the Hyper Smash. And the cool thing about it was the colorway that I bought was in homage to the 2008 Hyper Dunks. So it's been crazy because I keep wearing the sneaker everywhere. And the amount of people stopping me saying, hey, when did they retro the Hyper Dunk and when did they make it a low? And I was like, well, actually, and let me put you on game, it's still a tennis sneaker. So that's what I've been rocking. And then from a cop-in perspective, I actually, going cross-sport again, I was able to get my hands on the Kobe Barcelona kit, which I think is even better in person. So that's always an added plus whenever you buy something you have high hopes for. And then when you get it in the mail, it is even more pristine and detailed than you imagine. So that's it for me. Guillory, how about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a pretty unsophisticated sneakerhead. I do love shoes, but I definitely don't have the in-depth knowledge. Lately, been rocking these Last Resort low-top red suede skate shoes. I just love them because they kind of go with everything, and summer outfits is usually just t-shirts, shorts. It's pretty easy. Last thing I copped, though, was, as we were talking about before the show, I'm a new dad, so something to just slip on and get out the door and go for a little walk is really key right now. So I got these Nike ACG mules. I think they're called the Rufus.
Yeah.
So I was struggling with the fit on those, but I realized I had to size down a whole number, and then now they're great and super. I don't want to put on anything else. There's
no. It's funny you mentioned that as well, because my dad and mom recently moved into the greater Portland area where I am. Mm-hmm. And I always joke with him that he's a far better Nike employee than I could ever hope to be, because he's constantly wearing these Rufuses, these mules, the React Rejuvenates. I'm like, yeah, really, I'm visiting. You're the one that's a local.
Is Mr. Malhotra the style icon now?
Like the Don Dada? The Don Dada gene, I guess.
Clearly it's a shoe that clearly it's a shoe that works for multiple generations of dads now.
Oh, and so, I was going to say this, if you haven't been blessed by a pair of Monarchs, then the people in your life really need to get you those. And then Also, especially in the genre of slipping on and off, the Go Flyees, those have been game changers as well. So, because we are both dads of young children, and there's something about early morning that just gets their motor revving in a way that no other time of the day does.
That's right.
Awesome. Speaking of motor revving, let's talk about Carlos Alcaraz, who seems to have an unlimited motor, and then his foil, Carlos Sinner, who seems to have an unlimited amount of technical brilliance. So, Gary, if this is somebody's first instance of hearing about these two players, could you give us a quick elevator pitch on who they are as athletes, and then who are they as players, and kind of set that up in terms of the foundation of this rivalry that we'll chat about?
Yeah, it's a very fun rivalry. They have very satisfying kind of foils for one another in terms of their style and their temperament. So you get, it's a bit of a cliche, the fire and ice thing with a rivalry, especially in tennis. But the more I learned about these guys, the truer it seemed. And with Carlos, you have a guy who's born into an administrator of a tennis club and has kind of steeped in tennis his whole life, from got his first racket at age 4. And it's always been kind of a driving force in his life. Whereas with Yannick, he was a lot slower to come to tennis. He grew up in the Alps in northern Italy. And for him, skiing was the first athletic love. And he actually only went full-time, kind of in the full pre-professional pipeline of tennis, when he was 13, which is incredibly late as far as pros go. Usually they're more on the kind of Alcaraz trajectory. Yeah. So that's kind of an interesting wrinkle there. And he's been kind of more of a slow burn. And he made a sudden leap, I would say, from the fall of 2023 onward, where he kind of catapulted into the number one player in the world. And Alcaraz, meanwhile, had broken out a bit earlier in 2022, won his first major at the U.S. Open that year, and has this spectacular mix of feel and power and finesse and speed, and really combines elements of tennis that we have rarely, if ever, seen combined in one player. Whereas Yannick is more of a technician, and what he does with absolute precision and mastery in terms of his baseline game. I would say Alcaraz is a bit more unpredictable, Nick is a bit more reliable. They have a lot of really spectacular rallies when they meet on the same court. And I think it's just the hottest rivalry in the men's game right now. And it was fun to, I got a bit lucky in terms of, I set out to write this book at the end of 2023, and I was like, let's see how long it takes for these guys to develop. And the very next season, they split the four majors between themselves and had some fun matches against Novak Djokovic, who I consider the last member of the old guard. So the book is really about this change in the generations and the big three era, which we call the reign of Djokovic, Federer, and Nadal, is finally coming to an end as these two young superstars take over.
Yeah, that is, and it's crazy to see it, because me being a fan and playing tennis for so long in my life, when I really got into it, it was Federer was peaking. We got the introduction to Nadal, and then out of nowhere, you get Novak coming in. And watching that changeover, I think like any sports fan out there, probably more particularly NBA, once you lose those greats, you're like, we're gonna have this void.
Yep.
And there was not really a void. We got Sinner, we got Alcaraz pretty quickly, and not just like, oh, they won a major here sporadically like you would think it would be, but it's not much parity. It's like, he's gonna either be Sinner, is either gonna be Alcaraz. And it seems like we're gonna have this rivalry for years, because what, 22 23 or 23 24 respectively between the two?
That's right.
Yeah. I was going to ask. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, you guys being the tennis historians that you are, is it common for players to come up together? Because I have more of a North America sports brain, so I'm always used to seeing one player come up, kind of conquer the mountain, and then his next challenger is almost always like a year behind or 2 years behind. So I think that's what's jarring, lack of a better term, for me, is just kind of seeing these guys already having that bird magic type dynamic, and it's somewhat early in their career, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think what we haven't seen in a while, pretty much since that big three first breakout of those three players, is players quite this technically complete so early on in their careers. I would say over the last 15 years or so, the prime of a men's player had shifted a little back into the late 20s, perhaps. The idea of a teenage sensation was pretty much dead after Nadal. And I personally thought the game was just getting too physical for those kind of younger players to really have that level of success for those kind of prodigy breakouts. Right now we have, you know, Alcaraz at 19 showing he was physically mature to win 7 matches in a row to win a major. They seem to be in the thick of a rivalry already at 22 and 23. Sinner will turn 24 later this month. I think, it's one of those things where as a fan, even as a commentator or a writer, you always think that there's going to be this power vacuum and this void. But then you remember, like, it's an international game.
Yeah.
Millions of people playing all over the world. So much talent out there. Whatever gets turned up to the top is going to be pretty spectacular in its own way. And that was kind of the premise of the book, was like, you know, I know we've spent almost 2 decades in reverence towards these 3 great players. Let's try to show some love to the players who are coming up. And they've more than delivered on that promise already. Like, if you look at the matches they've played, even this summer, Roland Garros and Wimbledon, just... Mm-hmm. Insane level of tennis.
That's the thing. For a layman like myself, I can kind of understand that now, because I have preconceived notions of what I think tennis is, and the highest compliment I can pay them is simultaneously it looks like they're playing a different sport, but then other times it looks like they're playing the most traditional form. And that's what also attracts me to watching these two play, because it has become must-see TV, because the fact that there's just a balance. And sometimes I think we get so caught up in this win now or rings culture about, okay, this player has the upper hand because of the fact that they have more majors than the other. But I kind of like the fact that they're splitting them right now, because it builds up greater foundation, and I keep coming back to that. Mike, what about you? Like, is there anything that's popped out watching the two maturation process, especially as they dovetail quite nicely?
It's the thing that gets me is, like Gary mentioned, it's so early. You didn't see this. I mean, you started seeing signs of this from like Federer at that, you know, early 20s, mid-20s, like, oh, this guy's gonna be a problem. And same thing with Nadal. He was good, but again, he was more physical than anything, and then he started like really tightening up his game mid to late 20s. These guys are coming in 19, 20 years old and have already just kind of staked their claim to, hey, this is ours. And I don't know, Gary, you could really, like, I would love to hear your thoughts on this, but I feel like as tennis has become more available to people, it's not just kind of put aside for just the wealthy. I mean, it's definitely still a wealthy person's sport, but all of these camps, all of these places you can go send your kid to like live and play at. I think that's the reason we're getting them so early. And to Rohit's point earlier, while we're getting them all together, like, how are we getting such great players together? Because I think they're all kind of converging in these, I mean, lack of better words, factories to pump out amazing players. Because you have, like, Rafa has the camp. I'm sure that Federer has something. Everybody, there's in here in Texas, this at the Nukes in Austin. Like, you have all these places. They're converging to get these players who are even foregoing college at this point. Like, hey, I'm amazing out of high school. I catch you. You don't have all of Ben Shelton's going play through college. You having people come straight out of high school or still in high school becoming just fantastic.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems like there's a couple pipelines now to make it to the pros, where you do have the Sheltons who decide to go to college. It just keeps a little more options open, you know. And some people really like the developmental growth that you get in college too. But I would say we are seeing the growth of this, like, super academy, where you have and I think Sinner is perhaps an example of this, where he was a pupil of a coach named Riccardo Piatti, who set up this really excellent academy in the Italian Riviera. And Sinner at that point had just been kind of playing tennis with his hometown coaches, and he hadn't made that leap into that kind of pre-professional thing. But he got scouted. People saw his talent. He's one of those players where if you just hear him hit the ball in person once, you'll be like, this guy just has that timing, the ability to do something to a tennis ball that most people do not.
And like a gunshot.
Yeah, exactly. One of the first talent scouts described it as, like, he thought there was a construction site behind him, but it was just Sinner blasting tennis balls. He was scouted and brought over to this academy, and he had to travel, you know, across the country. He was living 7 hours away from his parents, who were in the Alps. It was definitely a huge change for him. But there's this new model where you come to these academies, you get world-class coaching, and they're kind of in it for the long haul. They're mm-hmm. trying to build a superstar and help build their name and their brand. And it's kind of hopefully something like a synergistic relationship between the academy and the superstar. But with Yannick, he's by far the most successful people to come out of that academy. And with Alcaraz, it was a bit more traditional tennis upbringing. He was mostly working at his hometown club for a long time. And then once it seemed like he was going to have talent just too big to contain there, they were able to bring in Juan Carlos Ferrero, who is a former major champion, former number one player in the world. And for him, it was like a bit of a gamble because he'd been working with more established pros and he was like, he had an academy of his own. Mm-hmm. And he was like, am I going to start traveling full time with this 15-year-old kid just on the basis of his promise? And that turned out to be exactly the right move because Alcaraz has delivered on all of that. And not too long from there, he was already winning professional matches. And he played Sinner in their first matchup when Alcaraz was 15 and Sinner was 17 on the Challenger Tour, which is kind of, you could see it as the minor leagues of the main ATP Tour. So, yes, slightly different tennis upbringings. But, yeah, we are seeing some different models in terms of how players can break into the pros in the first
place. And Mike, it's funny as well. You mentioned that concept of camps, right? Because we tend to be a basketball-focused podcast, so we're always hearing things about the LeBron camp or the CP3 camp or things like that. So it's really interesting to kind of see that that type of structure is now evolving into sports we previously probably thought would not be relevant. I will kind of use this as somewhat of a segue to talk to you, Gary, specifically around the fact that both of these guys are sponsored by Nike. And I know that with Alcaraz being a little bit more prominent, maybe his style is a little bit more Madison Avenue friendly in terms of it's very exciting, it's dramatic, whereas Sinner is, like you mentioned, a mechanic, a technician. There's a nuance in the beauty. Can you talk to me about how Nike has invested in both of these guys and what are some similarities and what are some differences? Because I think, especially coming off this most recent win that Sinner had, you finally started to see somewhat of a personality kind of come through. And I don't know if that's Nike unlocking the marketing puzzle, or was that Sinner giving himself a little bit more to the audience?
Yeah, I think initially, if you even go back as recently as the Indian Wells tournament last March, it seemed like Nike hadn't quite, figured out the branding or style challenge of like, you know, with Federer and Nadal, you had Federer in the cardigan. You had Nadal in his classic capri shorts and sleeveless and headband. So I feel like their styles diverge in a very clear and very satisfying way as a tennis fan. You got a sense of their personality from the clothes they had on. I think I would say it's still a work in progress for these two. I think we're starting to see some of their kind of style emerge in terms of the, you know, Alcaraz often in the sleeveless thing to following in the Nadal tradition, and he prefers kind of those brighter colors. Sinner, more muted tones, cool blues, greens, grays. And then when you look at the off the court branding, I think they do have a different appeal. I think Sinner kind of lends himself a little bit more naturally to the high fashion stuff. I think you look at some of the photo shoots that he does for Gucci and it's like, oh, this, you wouldn't think it just watching him play tennis, but then when he puts on the suit, it just kind of works. And then Alcaraz for sure has the more kind of show-stopping on-court vibe with just the variety of shots he hits. And he's a more natural showman in terms of getting the crowd involved and really... He speaks openly about it. It's a big theme of the book, but he draws a lot of his energy from the spectators. And he can sometimes lose his focus on the match when he feels like he's not putting on enough of a show. Whereas Sinner just kind of has his head down, absolute grinder.
Definitely. Yeah,
I was going to say this as well, as they kind of relate. Like if they weren't playing tennis, I could very much see Sinner being a Formula One driver based on that style and that elegance, and there's just something refined about him. And whereas Carlos feels like a global footballer or a soccer player, like there's just an explosiveness to his game. But Mike, I think I cut you off, so apologies on that front.
No, you guys, it's funny because as you started saying that, you look at the differences of the two, and it's crazy because it's not only different style, but if you look at just different like body type, because I was wondering, because when you look at those two across the court from each other, Yannick just looks like this tall, lanky guy, right? Like long limbs. I didn't realize he's only 3 inches taller than Alcaraz. Mm-hmm. So he's 6'3". Carlos is 6 foot even, or, you know, at least, you know, with shoes on. Mm-hmm. And they're just, again, two very different styles where he's kind of that long, lanky, like technical. He almost reminds me of Novak because he's just a wall.
Yeah.
Like, he's not necessarily going to be exciting all the time. They, it's kind of, I know it's kind of hard to market that non-exciting when you have Carlos on the other side who, again, exhibits those same traits as a football player, or soccer player, because he's very emotional, very outspoken, really relying on the crowd's energy. And I feel like Nike knows that, so they can really put a lot behind someone who's, you know, got the fireworks behind them and really going to have an experience when you watch them, as opposed to, I'm technical, I'm by the book, I'm going to make sure this ball gets back, and I'm going to make you lose. Because I feel like that's what Yannick is. I'm going to make you lose as opposed to me beating you all the time.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good comparison. A lot of people refer to Yannick as kind of the power-injected Djokovic, right? He's got a little more power from the baseline, but he does have this ability to just suffocate the opponent and make them feel like they don't have any options.
Yeah.
Whereas you kind of know what's going to be coming off his racket most of the time. Mm-hmm. Whereas Alcaraz is always keeping the opponent guessing, and he's really mixing up the kind of shots he's hitting. And I think that it's a different marketing challenge. I personally find Sinner's brand of tennis very compelling in its own way. If you get to see it in person, just like this, as I mentioned, the sound that's coming off his racket is incredible. But and when they get together, I think they bring out the best from one another. And I think each of them has something in his game that the other one envies a little bit as well. So it's yet with Sinner, it's the consistency that sometimes eludes Alcaraz. And with Alcaraz, it's the variety that Sinner's still trying to build into his own game. So I think we'll get to a point where we see them slowly converging and making each other better and trying to... It's kind of an arms race in a way, because if you take an example, Sinner was the first to kind of take a big step ahead on serve. He's a little bit taller, as you mentioned, which kind of opens up some new angles for him as a server as well.
Yeah.
And that's been key to him locking down the number one slot for most of the last year and a half. So I think with Alcaraz, it'll be a question of what he can add to his own game technically to keep up with that. Yeah.
So Gary, you mentioned a lot about Carlos's style. And so that's the question I'm going to ask you next. It's exciting. It's Mahomesian, which is the highest compliment I can pay it as a Chiefs fan. I guess my question to you, though, is it seems like it's a little bit more rigorous on his body. And there's the wear and tear that I almost associate with an American sports athlete. With him, do you see him evolving his style to that way not only continue to win at a high level, but something else that you've highlighted as we were chatting is he feels like a showman. He feels like he is not giving the crowd his money's worth. I could see him take some sort of unnecessary risk to get people off their feet. Like, do you see that kind of being curbed a little as he gets older, or do you think it's so baked in his DNA that that's who he's going to be? It's just he's going to pick his spots a little bit better.
Yeah, I think there's a couple factors. I think one is it's a thing that Roger Federer actually said after just commenting on Alcaraz's play late last year. He was like, he's an incredible player. Sometimes he chases down every ball like a puppy, and he'll learn to conserve his energy a little more carefully, and he'll learn kind of how to budget for the whole tournament rather than, you know, just that game or that set. So I think that's part of it. Yeah, and I think he's already shown great improvements on that front. I think another part of it is kind of maintaining the focus, because you'll see him early in a major tournament just give up a set or two sets to opponents he should be putting away a little more cleanly.
Yes.
And I think that's been, you know, to the extent that this guy has any issues in his game, and, you know, he's, to be clear, he's already on a historic trajectory as a player. It's one of the funny things, because I think his fans can catastrophize a little bit when he happens to have a rough patch in the tournament, but he's already got five majors and on all surfaces. So I think with him, it's a matter of, just maintaining the focus over the course of the tournament and not just logging extra mileage that you don't have to. And then the last factor, I think, is going to be a larger structural issue of scheduling on the tour, because I think the current schedule was set up to support a game that was not nearly as physical as the game that these guys are playing. on tour right now. And I think it's been one of the main themes of the last couple seasons is players constantly commenting on the burnout, the unrelenting pace of the tour. They basically have 3 weeks of off season, if that. And it's year round travel as well. And it's I think we're gonna see some big structural change over the course of these guys' career. I'd be surprised if he didn't, I should say, because I think they made their complaints pretty clear. And Alcaraz late last year was talking about how he just didn't have enough in the tank. And it was, he's the kind of guy who, when he does play a ton of tennis in a row, he likes to take a brief reset. He's been known for going to Ibiza in the middle of the summer between the French and Wimbledon.
Oh, okay.
So he did that. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I do it all the time. What are you talking
about? Yeah, right. He did that. He did it last summer and he won both back to back. And then he did it again this summer and he almost did both back to back again. So it's clearly players do need to find a way to refresh. But in terms of the physical stuff, I don't think I've seen that much that would concern me. I think with Nadal, he had this kind of congenital foot issue that they had to plan around for his whole career basically, and they came up with a kind of orthotic shoe insert that helped manage that pain. And then by the end of his career, he was getting treatments that would numb his foot. So he won the French Open on a foot that he could basically not feel. He said it felt like he was asleep, which is just ridiculous. So
that's insane.
These guys do get very resourceful with how they manage their bodies. And I think with Alcaraz, we've seen a bit of some muscle issues here and there, but nothing that makes me think he should change the way he plays. More, as I was saying, kind of the maintaining focus and not exerting excess effort when he doesn't need to. But I think the basic play style is good, and he shouldn't change anything. It's working really well.
See, what he needs to implement is that Novak second set trainer call out, just to, you know, hey, just hang out here for a minute, guys. Don't mind me. I hurt somewhere. It's okay.
Yeah. To that point, like, I think he'll become a bit savvier about how he manages matches and how he just resets and gets things done. Because he has a tendency at this point of his career to kind of let things drag on a bit longer than she said, whereas Sinner's always been kind of ruthlessly efficient in terms of handling just the early matches in a major quite efficiently.
And so with regards to Sinner, I think initially when we were prepping for this interview, I'd given you a question around his marketability, and you kind of already answered that when we had that kind of tangent on the Nike influence on both these guys. So let me rephrase this question for you, Geary. Is Sinner likable? And the reason why I ask this is he seems to have I wouldn't say a magnet for controversy, because if nothing else, I'll borrow the analogy that Mike gave me in a previous conversation where he's essentially Tim Duncan. He's just so advanced and so technically proficient that if you're not at his level, it's not fun to watch and it's not fun to play against because he's that much better than you. But then, much like those Spurs and Tim Duncan, whenever they met that right amount of competition, the games that they were in became so memorable. And then that knock on wood, that killed that narrative of the Spurs are boring. So I think similarly, Sinner is not boring. He just refuses to play down to his competition. And I guess just talk to me about him as a person. And the other example I guess I'll use is I was listening to another podcast that you were on, and you mentioned two things about Sinner specifically that stuck with me, which is when he's at his best, it's like playing an opponent in two times the podcasting speed, which is something that Mike and I kind of talk about a lot as well. Is there's that. And then there's also the Kyrgios. Mike, was it the rolling eyes emoji? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So as Rowan and I were just talking, I've talked about the likability of Sinner. At first, it was one of those things. He reminded me of Novak when he first came in. Not that, you know, Novak let his personality start eking in as he got older and became outspoken, but Sinner, you know, stays pretty quiet, stays to him, you know, generally to himself, seems like. And I don't think anybody had issue with him. I feel like the issue came when he tested positive for that banned substance inadvertently twice. And as we were talking, there were so many other players that had, you know, banned substance issues that got punishment. And just so happens this coincided him reaching number one for the first time in 2023. Mm-hmm. And basically, he got a slap on the wrist with a $325,000 fine and what, 400 tour point deduction. Fellow players like Nick Kyrgios really found it appalling that, hey, if this happened to anybody else, he would be like booted for 2 years. And it seems like once that happened, it wasn't just Kyrgios, it was plenty of players. I remember seeing just a laundry list of people coming out with tweets, quotes to reporters that they just didn't think it was fair and they really didn't want to have anything to do with Sinner at that point.
All right, we took a quick love break as, once again, I'm learning the game, but we wanted to start this next round of questions around Sinner's likability. We've talked a little bit about his marketability, but Sinner tends to be a polarizing character on the tour. So I was wondering if I could get your perspective on that, Gary, and then Mike, feel free to add any additional context as well.
Yeah. I know we were talking about just his likability, not just because of play style, because clearly he's a great, right? He has a great trajectory right now. He's only going up unless something crazy were to happen. But back in 2023, likability when it comes to fans and fellow tour members, both men and women alike, took a shot because he not only tested positive once, but twice for a banned substance. And although it said it was because of some kind of massage cream from a personal trainer, a lot of people weren't buying it. So like fellow tour member Nick Kyrgios, lots to say on Twitter. And we all know that Nick Kyrgios is very outspoken. So with his success kind of following that or right kind of in tandem because he had just reached number one at that same time, has this recent string of majors helped to forgive and forget, repair that? Or is it making it worse because like, well, what are you doing now to keep this level up? So what do you think on that?
Yeah, I think I would start with just a general point about his personality, which is very pretty big contrast to Carlos in that I think he would be content doing his job in an empty stadium sometimes. I think for him, it's very much about what's happening between the lines. And yeah, he definitely appreciates the beauty and like the pressure of the game, but he's kind of a more private guy by disposition. And I think he is maybe still adapting to the idea that in 2025, if you're a tennis player, you're also kind of an influencer and you're kind of doing talk shows and all this stuff. I think for him, if he could just keep his personal and professional lives totally separate, mm-hmm. he'd probably prefer it that way. That's just not the reality of how the game works right now. Yeah. So I think that's one thing he struggles with. But when you do catch him in these occasional moments of vulnerability, I think he's a pretty thoughtful and interesting guy to talk to. It's not as naturally translatable to the screen or to the phone screen as Alcaraz is, but I think there's some depth to him as a person, and I enjoyed those occasional these exchanges as reporting the book.
Nice.
With the doping stuff, I think it brought in a lot of skepticism from his mm-hmm. colleagues, to the point where he was mentioning even this year in the Australian Open, he was picking up on some bad vibes in the locker room and he was considering taking a break from the tour.
Wow.
He ended up having a settlement with kind of doping court and having to mm-hmm. take that 3-month break anyway. But what I think that shows is players are kind of slow to forgive or forget. Mm-hmm. Personally, me just speaking my point of view, having reviewed kind of the facts of his case in detail, it's very hard for me to believe that he was trying to deliberately get an advantage by using this substance. It's just not kind of what you would do, and the risks are greatly outweigh the reward. So,
yeah,
as strange as the massage excuse looks on paper, it's hard for me to believe he's deliberately gaming the system. But that being said, I think all these guys use everything right up to the line of what's legal. And they are using all kinds of getting creative with the supplements and the treatment and whatnot. So I think it's one of those things where winning more and more doesn't necessarily take the target off your back from your colleagues. If anything, maybe it makes it a little bit worse. Because I think there are players such as Nick Kyrgios suggesting that there should be an asterisk behind his accomplishments now. That he was doping and that was the reason. I think if you look at Sinner's kind of body of work and what he's accomplished, it's clear he's got an underlying talent mm-hmm. for tennis, and he's winning tennis matches because of his talent. But it can be a tricky environment in terms of rehabbing your reputation after an incident like this. And some players kind of wear that for the rest of their careers. So it's a very jarring contrasts on the surface, where you have this guy who's completely no nonsense and introverted, and then you look at the kind of drama that's been swirling around his camp over the last 18 months, and it's hard to reconcile those two things. But
right.
and in fact, just in the last few weeks, he rehired the fitness trainer that he had. The fitness trainer that he had during the time of mm-hmm. the kind of doping. Yeah,
didn't know that. That's a choice.
yeah. I think the rationale there was that getting into the weeds is I won't get too far in the weeds, but I think the gist of it was that his camp felt it was another member of the team who made the mistake, the one who actually administered the massage, and this member was just the one who happened to have that kind of topical cut healing cream on his person for personal use during the trip. So
got you.
There's a little wrinkle nuance there, but the headline still looks super weird. Like, why bring this guy back after a mistake like that? So Sinner has been a lot more complex a figure even than I expected when I set out to write the book. You never expect him to catapult to number one in the world and then immediately have this banned substance controversy. It in a way it made the book more narratively interesting because I got to tell the story and I got to observe him in some of these really charged, tense moments of his career when he was figuring out how to talk about this stuff in public. But that said, you never want a player to be going through something like that. It's
for sure.
It's just kind of dicey stuff. So
yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of what I would say about him as a personality.
And you had mentioned Kyrgios. I think he may probably have aged out in terms of a possible Djokovic-type figure that may break up this rivalry.
Yep.
Are there any players on the tour or anybody that you could think that could serve as that foil to the two
yes.
of them? Or what are some other external factors that you could see possibly ending this rivalry before it really reaches a climax?
It's a great question. I would say maybe not even just end the rivalry, but push it into a new gear. Because if you look at what Djokovic did for Federer and Nadal, I think he forced both of them to get better in ways that enriched their rivalry against one another. And I would personally, just as a for the fan side of me, would love if there's a third contender that can turn it from two rivalries into three distinct rivalries. And maybe a fourth. Who knows? I see no reason why it should be just locked into an era of just these two forever. But right now, I would say the contenders, there are a couple names you could throw out there. I think João Fonseca out of Brazil is a pretty exciting young player who hasn't really broken out in a huge way at the majors. But a lot of tennis fans are excited. Just the sheer power he has from the baseline is pretty comparable to Sinner. I don't think he's physically as far along as those two guys are in terms of their just movement and conditioning. But yeah. He's still working on all that. And then Jack Draper out of the UK is another very talented contemporary of these guys. Lefty, big serve, really technically sound game. And then I honestly think Holger Rune was a name from Denmark, was a name that was cropping up more in these conversations two or three years ago. Has failed to kind of keep pace with the advances that these guys have made, but he's a contemporary of theirs, just a few weeks apart from Alcaraz on birthday, and has a lot of really impressive tech features to his game. Great athlete, great ground stroke. So it's possible he becomes more of a late bloomer than they are, and it kind of enters the fray. But it's also possible that the true rival to these guys is 15 or 16 and we don't know quite who he is yet, in the same way that Federer was a half generation older than Djokovic. We'll see someone come from a different age bracket and make it interesting.
For sure.
Mike, you got a name for me?
See, I mean, I'm a homer, you know. I'm always hoping for American to come in there,
like a Shelton.
I look at Shelton and I feel like he's like the modern reincarnation of Andy Roddick. Like, he's always going to be a disruption, but he's not there, not quite winning enough.
Yeah.
But I think if he just honed in his game, maybe, and I hate to say it because I think his dad's doing a great job, but I think he needs a coach who's been there. I mean, his dad's played, of course, but he needs someone who's been to the top
at that level. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he could be that disruption, that maybe that person comes in like third or fourth to join the party.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been really impressed by kind of how rapidly he's made an impact at the majors. And I think that serve automatically puts him in the conversation in any match he's in. And it's been interesting. He actually seems a little bit more comfortable on like the clay courts than I expected so far. He played an incredible match against Alcaraz there in Paris, was super competitive through like the first two sets. So he's a guy I see kind of in that just next tier down. But it would be fascinating if he can make those technical improvements. To me, it would probably be his backhand is something to work on. And then, I mean, he knows all this stuff too. And then just kind of getting that consistency from the baseline so that someone like a Sinner doesn't know that they can just outlast him over a 9-10 shot rally. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So thank you for mentioning Shelton. I've married into a family full of Gators, so now they can justify listening to this podcast. And I will use this segue. We talked about great dads in tennis. We've got esteemed company joining Gary as well. Gary, if you could pluck a couple things from both Sinner and Alcaraz's game to impart to your daughter so that way she could be a great tennis player, what would you pick?
I think I would pick Alcaraz's love of novelty. I think that's one of the things that makes him such a great player psychologically. If you're on the other side of the net, he could be hitting a drop shot that bounces, just dribbles like 2 feet from the net. He could be hitting a 100-mile-an-hour forehand that blows right past you. And the fact is, you don't know which of those shots it's going to be until he's making contact with the ball because his deception is so good. So I think the fact that he is always seeking novelty when he's on the court can be his pitfall at times, but 95% of the time it's what makes him such kind of historically interesting player. And and I think it just keeps the sport that can otherwise become quite monotonous, it keeps it pretty fresh for you. Even you're playing your 70th or 80th match of the season, if you still feel like I'm trying to do something new every time you step out there, I think it adds a lot to his game. And then with Sinner, I think I would take the what we call in tennis circles, I would take the ball striking. So if you look at the way he just smacks the ball in the center of his racket with perfect timing over and over again, he's kind of metronomic in a way. And to his detractors, they would say he's robotic. But I think for someone who does enjoy the beauty of really precise technical tennis, I think that's probably the feature I would take from him, the ball striking.
Excellent. Yeah. Sweet spot every time. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, you can hear it. You can hear it.
You can.
This reminds me of, I forgot whatever the unnamed baseball movie is. It's just certain players they hit differently, and Sinner is very much in that genre.
Yes.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that was Gary Nathan. The book is The Changeover, A Young Rivalry in a New Era of Men's Tennis. I have been Rote Malhotra. My esteemed host is Mike Guillory. We thank you so much for listening to our podcast. If you like us, please rate, review, subscribe, and please buy the book. Comes out August 19th. Any parting thoughts, Gary, before we end?
I would just say I really appreciate you guys taking the time to reach out to me, and I hope we get another 10 years of these guys going at it, because the matches so far have been wild, and I would love to write a sequel to the book. So
hey, and when you do, what happens. You know, two knuckleheads in the greater sneaker universe that are willing to have you on the podcast. So
love it. Thank you guys.
Excellent. Thank you guys so much. And we'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey y'all, Nick here. One more thing before you take off. Do us a solid and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Check the links in the description to help us keep the show going. And as always, we appreciate you listening. And don't forget to tell someone you like their kicks today. You never know how far a compliment will take you. And we all know how good it feels to be on the receiving end of some appreciation. Peace.